Welcome to the Moneyball Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Harry Glorikian. This series is all about the data-driven transformation of the healthcare and life sciences landscape. Each episode, we dive deep through one-on-one interviews with leaders in the new cost-conscious, value-based healthcare economy. We look at the challenges and opportunities they're facing and their predictions for the years to come. The average doctor these days understands very well that for certain diseases, there are genetic biomarkers that are very important. And he or she understands how to use that piece of information. But what happens when they are confronted with a report of 400 different mutations at different locations in the genome? It's not clear that people know how to make sense of that. My next guest has been working on a large-scale DNA analysis project that could one day put much more usable information into the hands of oncologists. They have been collecting and analyzing thousands of tumor samples from cancer clinics. He has stated many times that this is the next big frontier, that the American oncology community, the research centers, and the cancer centers need to work harder on translating all of this data into usable, understandable data for the practitioner. Dr. Barrett Rowlands is the Chief Scientific Officer and Faculty Dean for Academic Affairs at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston and the Lindy Family Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. After graduating from Amherst, Dr. Rowlands earned his PhD and medical doctorate from Case Western Reserve University in 1979 and 1980, respectively. Dr. Rowlands is recognized for his pioneering clinical research and his organizational leadership. By adapting the effective practices of innovative businesses, he has fostered a collaborative and curiosity-driven culture of rigorous inquiry at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, attracting renowned faculty to several multidisciplinary research centers. He is the driving force behind Dana-Farber Cancer Institute's Profiling Project, one of the nation's most comprehensive precision medicine initiatives. Profile aims to detect genetic alterations in tumors, and its genomic profiling database is derived from more than 13,000 patients, with 5,000 more added each year. Each patient sample is scanned for abnormalities in 300 cancer-causing genes, potentially providing a guide towards targeted treatments. Dr. Rowlands is working to ensure the access to these powerful techniques, and that's one of the subjects we're going to describe today. Dr. Rowlands, welcome to Moneyball Medicine.
Thanks very much, Harry. It's great to talk to you.
So, Dr. Rowlands, let's step back here. Tell me, for those listeners, what does a chief science officer of a hospital do? It sounds like almost a chief science officer of a company, but this is a medical institution. So what do you do on a day-to-day basis and your goals?
Yeah, so it's a great question. It is kind of clear, for those of you who are in the know, it's kind of clear what a chief scientific officer at a company does. A chief scientific officer sets the research direction for the company, basically decides what the R&D goals are and the priorities are, and then the company moves forward. In academics, the situation is quite different. All of the researchers at my institution and at most institutions are essentially independent contractors. They come and they work on whatever they can raise money to work on, and we kind of guide them forward. If I were to take on the chief scientific officer role at a company and try to direct what my colleagues were doing scientifically, my head would be on a pike on Brookline Avenue. That's not what my colleagues need. Instead, in the academic world, what a chief scientific officer does, and at least what I've sort of set as my goal, is to make the research life of my colleagues easier. I try to find ways to get them resources. I try to find ways to give them infrastructure so that they can do the work that they need to do. And when I say they, I include myself, since I still have a functioning operating lab. We do discovery research in some rare childhood tumors. And one example of this would be about 10 years ago, it became clear that we needed to have a facility to be able to do imaging on small animals. We needed to be able to do MRI scans, PET scans, CT scans on mice as we were starting to look at new therapies. And we just didn't have an opportunity to do that, especially where we're located in the Longwood Medical Area in Boston, which is one of the most overbuilt areas in the country. But, I worked with the mayor's office in the city of Boston, worked with some donors, and found a place to do this in South Boston, and now we have a thriving, very high-functioning small animal imaging facility. It's that kind of thing that I try to do for my colleagues.
So you and I have been talking for it seems like a very long time since the first time we spoke to each other about genomic profiling, something near and dear to your heart. I think I remember you saying something like, anybody who's not doing it, it's like Barbary. But this was almost 6 years ago when you made that statement to me. So can you tell me about genomic profiling, where you believe it is today?
So Harry, the basis for talking about genomic profiling is the understanding that cancer is a disease of genes. I mean, that's the really big insight that's occurred in the past 20 years or so. What I mean by that is that, you know, the problem in cancer is that cells grow and they continue to grow even when they're not supposed to. And that process of growth is not passive. It doesn't happen just because there's food and water around. Growth of cells happens under the control of certain genes. Certain genes tell a cell to grow when it should and to stop growing when it shouldn't. And the problem in cancers is that in essentially every cancer we know about, there's been a mutation in a gene that's led to an alteration in the structure of a protein that directs cell growth. These proteins that direct cell growth have an interesting property, which is that they can toggle back and forth between being active and inactive. And what happens in most cancers is that the gene damage has led to a change in the structure of the protein, so it's stuck in the on position. It no longer toggles back and forth. So while that may seem like a very dire situation, in fact, it's an opportunity. If you can make a drug, which is really just a small molecule that can bind to that protein and flip it back into its inactive position, you have at the very least stopped the growth of the cancer, but it's really better than that. A lot of these cancers have become dependent on that abnormal protein. The term of art we use is addicted. They become addicted to the protein, so that when you inhibit it, the cell actually dies, and now the cancer lump can shrink. So why do we want to know what all the mutations are in cancers? Well, it's because for a certain number of mutations, we have drugs that actually do what I just described. It can flip those abnormal proteins into their off position. But what you want to know is, who has the mutation? Who doesn't? Who should we give the drug to? Who should not get that drug, but maybe some other drug? This is the essence of what we are now calling precision cancer medicine, which is a precise approach to patients by getting a sample of their cancers or their leukemias or the lymphomas and doing DNA sequencing. If we find a mutation that predicts a response to a targeted therapy, we can give that targeted therapy. And in most cases, with high predictive power, that cancer will shrink and patients may be able to live longer. That's really the essence of what we're doing here.
So you and I have been talking about this for quite some time. Where do you see the technology impacting today? Where do you see the technology working? And there are some naysayers for saying there's the papers that we'd love to see, that we thought we'd see by now, we would have seen. So where are we in this whole process?
So I think there are two ways to answer that question. One is the really direct way that has to do with patients, and the other is a little bit more aspirational. So the first way I would answer that question is that in certain diseases, maybe as many as 12 to 15% of cancers, there is a very, very clear-cut clinical pathway. Somebody who has a melanoma, cancer of the skin, you do DNA sequencing on that melanoma, and if they have a mutation in a gene called BRAF, you give them a drug called vemurafenib, or one of its next-generation versions, and that tumor shrinks away. There is a problem with those cancers eventually becoming resistant to that drug, but then we find new mutations and give them new drugs, and they can actually keep people going for a very long time. When I think about the current treatment of lung cancer, that's a particularly striking example. When I was in training, if a patient came to my clinic who had a certain kind of lung cancer that spread outside of the lung, I could start a clock when I saw that patient, and 6 months later that patient would be dead, no matter how much chemotherapy I poured into that patient. But now we know that if that patient has a mutation in a certain gene called EGFR, there's a pill we can give that patient that will make the cancer shrink and make that patient live for as long as that drug works. Again, with a single drug, we often see resistance appear. In other words, the cancer comes back, but now There's a second generation drug we can give to a lot of those patients with their new mutations, and there's even a third generation drug beyond that. So now the survival of that cancer has gone way beyond 6 months. It's changed the standard of care. Now, I don't want to oversell this. I think that the skepticism that some people have around the true impact on overall survival in cancer as of 2018, that skepticism may be justified, because we're not helping every patient who comes to clinic. But the pathway towards helping everybody is quite clear. And that's the second goal, this aspirational goal. We need to do more research. We need to sequence more patients. We need to find more mutations and make more drugs, because this is so clearly the future of cancer care.
So do you think it's just a matter of the N, the number, because every institution only has a certain number, so your N is so small, relatively speaking, that if we could pool all this data, that we might move a little bit faster?
So that's a great question, and the answer is unequivocally yes. This is a numbers game. I'm very proud to say that Dana-Farber is one of the leading institutions, along with Memorial Sloan Kettering and some others, in a project called Project Genie. Genie is an acronym for something that I can't remember now, but Genie is sponsored by the American Association for Cancer Research. It began as a consortium of 7 cancer centers who have pooled all of their sequencing data. We just had a new request for applications for new memberships. There are now 18 of these institutions, and they have dedicated themselves to providing all of their clinical sequencing data to go into a central database. And 6 to 12 months after we donate those data into the central database, they're made available to the public. Anybody can sign on and dive into that database and ask questions and do research on those data. And with big numbers like that, we're going to get up to close to 100,000 samples within a couple years. With big numbers like that, you find really interesting results that have clinical application.
Do you have any examples that you might be able to share that of how that you saw something that you didn't see because now the numbers are larger?
So Genie is relatively young, so I don't have a good example of that yet.
Okay.
But what I do know is that when we go into that database, I'll tell you, not only are our researchers interested, but drug companies are really interested.
Yes.
So breast cancer, there may be 30 different kinds of breast cancers depending on what the mutations are. And certain drug companies might have a drug against the mutation in gene X, which is relatively rare. No, as you said before, no one institution is going to have enough of those patients to be able to understand what their clinical outcomes are. But I do know of at least 2 projects in Project Genie, sponsored by a drug company. You go into Genie's big database, and they're finding, you know, a dozen patients with this mutation, enough that they can start to see what the clinical outcome is, and also to know that it's feasible to do a clinical trial where you recruit only those patients with those mutations to see whether or not they respond to the drug. So this is also a way to accelerate the development of targeted therapeutics.
So that brings me sort of to another thing is, how do you see this technology, this direction and capability changing medical practice? Now, I don't even want to say physician practice, because it's sort of one super layer above that, and how it changes how we practice medicine. Because right now we have, departments are sort of spread apart by anatomy more than anything else, where this sounds like it's above it and it's attacking it by pathway. So how do you see this changing physician practice, oncology practice, et cetera?
Yes, it's going to change practice in a couple profound ways. What you just said about pathway-based diagnosis, I think, is entirely accurate. We're already seeing situations where it matters very much less whether a cancer arose in a lung or a colon or a thyroid or the skin, then that they all have the same pathway abnormality. We're seeing more and more demonstrations of this in what are called basket trials, in which the clinical trial requirement used to be, we're looking at lung cancer patients or we're looking at colon cancer patients. Now it's, you can get on the trial if you have a mutation in BRAF, a gene called BRAF. Doesn't matter, what the anatomic location is. Now, anatomic location is going to continue to be important. Clinically, the requirements for taking care of somebody with a cancer of their head and neck is very different from the clinical requirements of taking care of somebody with a skin cancer. But the fundamental first-line treatment it may not matter. And so oncologists are already starting to become pathway experts rather than anatomic experts. Oncologists are already getting, they're starting to get used to looking at reports about genomic abnormalities. In our own example of our project that you referred to earlier, Profile, initially I will say that most of my clinical colleagues were saying things like, you know, why am I wasting my time getting consent from these patients where this isn't really going to help them? You know, what are you guys doing? And we had to convince them to keep doing it. I completely understand, you know, being a clinical oncologist is busy, busy, busy work. Now, three or four years later, if we have a temporary technical glitch in Profile and the results don't get out fast enough, my phone rings off the hook. Where are my Profile results? Even when it's not clear that it's necessarily going to help somebody, it's been totally integrated into care. At the very top of this broadcast, you talked about oncologists trying to understand, you know, the results of 400 genetic tests at once.
Yep.
That's the next big frontier. How do you use the tools of informatics, of the tools whereby you take lots and lots of data and boil it down to its essence? How can you use those tools to have busy practitioners understand what's going on with a patient's genetics? Okay. That we need to do. At the same time, we also need, I think, to make getting genetic results on cancer patients as common as getting a blood test. It's a genetic disease. Let's get this on everybody. You know, I think that the insurers, I understand why the insurers want to be shown that there's a real benefit to this. I share their desire for evidence. I think we'll be able to show them that evidence in the near future, and we'll find that just like your blood counts are covered by insurers when you go to the physician, whether or not there may be a direct need to know what your white blood count is that day, I think this kind of genetic profiling will also be covered because it gives you a snapshot on today, at this point in time, about where that cancer is, and now you know how it might change in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that it has to be available to the normal oncologist. I talk to different friends in the community, and they will say that, you know, there are a lot of oncologists that don't order these tests, which I think is, you know, I think is lunacy, but they'll basically say they don't understand it, so they won't order it, which is sort of interesting when you think about how the patient is being managed. So I think that those tools, how do you see those tools rolling out to the average oncologist per se?
Yeah, so I want to be careful. I don't want to oversell this because, I mean, I'm a zealot here because I'd like to think I see the future, and I think the future is that there's going to be huge benefits for everybody. But we have, to be fair, we have not demonstrated this yet. And so if an oncologist plays the odds and thinks that, you know, 80 to 85% of the patients that he or she sees aren't going to benefit, I can imagine them making the internal argument, let's not do this, unless it's in some kind of research capacity. On the other hand, you know, this is clearly where we're going. And the sooner that we can figure out a way to make this a common and understandable test for oncologists, the better off we'll be. I think that the evolution of companies like Foundation Medicine will be extremely helpful, that, you know, they are targeted, their audience is really the practitioner and not the academic center. That will help democratize some of this genetic testing. I think another reason that community oncologists may be a little bit leery to order this test is that if an insurer doesn't pay for it, well, who's going to pay for it? The patient.
Right.
And I think we have to be very cognizant of the potential burden we're going to place on patients if insurers won't pay.
Yeah, yeah. So we talked about how physician practice is going to change. How do you see this changing anything from drug discovery, which you alluded to if you know the pathway, do you really care what the brand name of the drug is, or do you just care that it's XYZ 121 and it perturbs a particular pathway? How do you see that changing the way that a physician might prescribe or utilize or how that medication might be paid for based on an outcome?
Well, I think eventually the FDA is going to tie approval of a specific targeted therapy to the presence of the abnormality that predicts for the response. And so I don't think that practitioners will have to worry too much about choosing among drugs that target the same abnormality. The FDA will help us out by saying, you know, this is the drug for that abnormality. There may be other ways in which this kind of work accelerates helps oncologists out in a different way. So I want to be careful here. You know, one of the things, unlike many other specialties, one of the things that's unique about oncology is oncologists tend to use clinical trials as a basis for their therapies, especially in patients who have failed frontline therapies. I'm not sure I always agree with that because, you know, the whole reason something's a clinical trial is because it's not standard of care, and I want to be careful that patients don't think that we're offering a clinical trial because we think it's really, because we know it's going to help them. And if we knew it was going to help them, it would be standard of care.
Yes.
Nonetheless, my colleagues always beat me up around this because they know that they use these trials to often help patients. And obviously, we wouldn't be testing something if we didn't think there was some evidence that it was going to help somebody. But one of the things that's happening now is these trials are really designed around specific genetic abnormalities. So how do you find, let's say you're an oncologist and a patient comes to you and you do their sequencing and you find they have a mutation in gene X. Well, how do you find a trial of a drug that's targeted against gene X? Well, we can use computational biology to help us with this. We have a wonderful informatician at our institution and other places have people like this who create programs that match abnormalities to a clinical trial. Our version is called MatchMiner. Open source, it's a great tool. If a patient comes in and has that mutation, the provider can go into Epic, call up MatchMiner, and see that there, you know, these trials are available for that patient, and try to get the patient on the trial. It's an incredible time saver. Now, on the other side, if you're a clinical investigator at an academic institution and you want to fill all the slots in your trial for this magic drug that targets gene X, how do you find these patients with a mutation? You go into MatchMiner, and you find the patients with a mutation. You try to enroll them on your trial. That's going to really speed up the development of drugs.
Okay. So let's switch gears here for a second. The big hot topic is immuno-oncology. Everything seems to be, and the valuations are astronomical of these drugs. Although I'm looking at all the numbers, and on the people that it works great, and for the people that it doesn't work on, it's not so great, and the logistics are daunting even to think about. Where do you see that evolving, and how do you see it really being implemented into practice?
So immuno-oncology is incredibly exciting, especially exciting for those of us who've been in the field for 40 or 50 years and have been thinking about immunology all that time. Finally, it turns out, you know, there's something going on here. But this falls into the same paradigm. It falls into the same precision oncology paradigm. Because think of the problem. There are about seven cancers in which the current generation of checkpoint blockers, the nivolumabs and so on, work. And even within those cancers, only about 30% of patients respond. So the big question is, how can you figure out who's going to be a responder and who's not? Who's going to have those bad side effects and who's not? Well, we think we can apply the same kind of ideas that we applied in profile to immunoprofile. We want to get everybody's cancers, do immune profiling, see what kind of immune cells are in the cancers, what kind of proteins do they express, what is the immune status of their cancers, and try to correlate that with outcome, with whether or not they respond to these drugs. And once you do that, you can then target these therapies to individual patients. Those kinds of data can also be used to develop the next generation of immune-oncology interventions, things that will block other aspects of the immune response. But I do think, ultimately, it's going to fall into the same category. And you know, one of the biggest advances in immune-oncology was the discovery, and again, this was agnostic as to anatomic location. If you have a cancer that has many, many, many mutations in it, discovered by this kind of DNA sequencing that we were talking about before, the FDA has approved one of these checkpoint blockers for those patients. So, you know, there's a convergence here, not only of the genetics, but also the immunology. And in the immune-oncology sphere, that's where I see a lot of promise.
So it's interesting. You mentioned outcomes and correlating them all. So I'm just curious. At some point, I keep thinking about this like a loop. Right? If I have enough patients and I've had enough outcomes under enough treatments, it sort of feeds back to what the best treatment pathway should be for the patient. Are you seeing that, the fruits of that yet here at Dana-Farber? Because you've been doing this longer than other places, most other places.
So, you know, again, this is an example of seeing where we want to go. It turns out that it's actually quite easy to get DNA sequence on somebody's cancer. You know, yeah, it took us several years to set it up, and we broke a bunch of systems, and it's hard for us to pay for it, but it's easy to do that test. You know what's hard? What's hard is to find clinical outcomes in a way that can be analyzed. Everybody's electronic health record has just, you know, an incredible amount of really important data in those records. But one of my colleagues likes to say that the information is, it's imprisoned. You can't get it out because the data aren't structured in a way that allows you to do, you know, machine-based queries. So right now, one of the most exciting things that we're working on is a machine learning-based way to get into those charts, to be able to read what a physician has said about his or her patient, a way to read the CT scan results that show whether a tumor grew or didn't grow, a way to read all of the pathology reports and structure them in a way that we can do large queries across hundreds or thousands of patients. That's where the recursive sort of loop is going to come, when you can really correlate detailed clinical outcomes with the genetic or immunologic status of those patients. And that's the next big thing. And you know, you're in this space, you know that there are any number of companies that have promoted themselves as the company that's figured this out, whether it's Flatiron or somebody else. Let me tell you, Harry, nobody has figured this out. Everybody always goes back to the gold standard, which is somebody sitting in front of a chart, reading the chart and abstracting the information onto some kind of clinical research form. We want to get rid of that, but nobody is there yet.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I always think, like everybody, it's such a fallacy to call the system an electronic medical record when it was original. It was built from the ground up for billing.
It's a billing system.
It's
that's
a billing
exactly
system.
Right.
And so it's, I think that's one of the biggest impediments to advances in medicine. Which I'm hoping Apple and some of these other guys might try to tackle and solve for us. If you had to paint a picture, knowing that you're passionate about this, is where do you see this evolving? How do you see this playing a role in the next 5 years?
You know, the real goal here, the real goal is to develop a synoptic picture of a patient. In other words, you want to be able to have in a single sort of snapshot the patient's genomic abnormalities in their tumor, their germline genomic abnormalities, in other words, the parts of their genetics that put them at risk for getting cancer. You want to be able to look at all of their imaging studies. You want to be able to look at all of their pathology studies and all of their clinical outcomes in a single sort of user interface that would allow both clinicians and researchers to get into those data. It's so clearly where we want to go. It's so clearly the right thing in order to really understand what happens with cancer and what happens with our interventions in cancer. Until we do that, we're always going to be missing some piece of the puzzle. So the research goals over the next several years is to do stuff like that. And once you get those kinds of data and start applying artificial intelligence to those large data sets, you could start to make predictions and then be able to go back, say, and figure out what characteristics in a normal population identify people at high risk of cancer. Who do we want to screen? Who do we want to make sure we do blood tests looking for markers of early cancer? Because the real, you know, another big goal is to be able to prevent what we're seeing rather than simply to treat it. So that's sort of where I see things going over the next several years.
So you're talking about liquid biopsies playing a major role in where this is going.
Liquid biopsies, but even if we can find markers that predict for the appearance of cancers at some level, enough so that we're willing to spend the money to screen those patients, it's not even biopsies then. It's finding markers that are predictive and then monitoring patients and getting cancer at its earliest stage.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. I always look forward to continuing our conversation as things evolve. And I wish you and Dana-Farber incredible success because I'm not getting any younger.
Yeah, you and me both, Harry. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. And that's it for this episode. Join me for the next episode where I speak to Massimo Buscema, who is the director of the Semeon Research Center in Rome, Italy, and full professor at University of Colorado at Denver. We'll be diving a bit deeper into AI and its applications in healthcare and how it can truly enhance what we can see and uncover what we cannot. If you enjoyed Moneyball Medicine, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is greatly appreciated. Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.